step in and look at it. Well, first of all, I want to take this opportunity to wish everybody a Happy New Year. And I hope that you all have a beautiful year and have a lot of love and growth and a lot of fulfillment. You know, this part of the year is special to me because last month, December, I celebrated 25 years clean in this program. And I didn't make it the first time I got here, or the second. I got here, the first time I came to a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous was in 1959. And at that time, there was only one meeting a week in the world. And the group, the entire NA group in the world, was less than 10 people. And I remember when I went to my first meeting, I met the entire group there. It was in a little sanitarium in North Hollywood. And this little sanitarium was where they used to send the alcoholics to dry, you know, to dry up. And the name of the sanitarium was Shire's Sanitarium, and we used to call it Shire's Dryer. And in the back room, they used to let the Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and the Narcotics Anonymous group hold their meeting. And I feel very, you know, very blessed because I'm the only one left of all those people. I'm the only one alive. The two people who are the founders of Narcotics Anonymous were there that night, who became very good friends of mine. And my sponsor, who was the fifth member of NA, he came to NA when NA was 3 months old. When I met him, he had 5 years clean. And they're not here anymore. I didn't make it that time. I had to go out. You know, and I thought for a long time that, you know, I thought, what a waste. What a waste. But you know what? It wasn't a waste. You know, it would be wonderful if we all came, and the first time we came, we said, it's all over. And we accepted it. But everybody's different. You know, I was different. I had to go out there, and I had to get to the point, you know, I had to get to that level that I finally got to the point I said, you know, it's all over. And a lot of people do come the first time, and they're at that level where they completely surrender to the fellowship. And for a long time, I thought, well, the program didn't work. It did work. It did work in spite of me, in spite of my refusal to accept the fellowship. It worked on me. Because after I came the first time, I went back out and I used, and I went back to another institution. And during the time I was in an institution, I went back for 3 years in a place in Leavenworth, Kansas, a federal institution. And during the time I was there, I used to think about this guy, Scott, who was my sponsor, the guy that brought me to NA. And the thing that impressed me more than anything else was that he was clean for 5 years. I had never met a drug addict, a dope addict, who was clean for 5 years. Because, you know, I grew up with that belief that, you know, once a dope fiend on the street, always a dope fiend on the street. I believe that. I really believe that. I believe that someday would come the time when I would die of an OD, or I'd get shot doing some crazy things, or, you know, I would die. I was never going to make it. And this really blew my mind when this guy told me he was clean and sober for 5 years. And when I went back to that institution, during the 3 years I was there, I used to think about this man, Scott, and I used to think to myself, if there's anybody that can help me, anybody, it's got to be this guy. And I told myself that when I get out of this place in Kansas, I'm going back to California, to Los Angeles, and I'm going to try to find this guy, and maybe he can help me. And that's what I did. I came back to California, and I found Scott. I stayed clean and sober for the first time in my life since I had started using drugs for 6 months. Clean and sober. I didn't take anything. I didn't work the steps. But I went to a meeting every night for 6 months. Every night I was at a meeting. And because I had never worked the steps, I used again. And I remember that it was December the 6th of 1962. I went into a place in Santa Monica called Synanon. And I stayed there a very short time because I left on Christmas Day of 1962. I was there a very short time. And you know what? I'm grateful to those people that they took me in. I'm grateful to Chuck Diedrich, who was the founder of Synanon. Because during the time I was there, they took care of me. They treated me with a lot of love. And they helped me get over that physical thing that I was going through. I couldn't stop by myself. I needed help. And those people helped me. You know, but I had been here once before. I had been clean and sober once before. And during the time that I was at Synanon, the miracle happened in my life. And the miracle is that I lost the obsession to use. And from that time on, until today, I have never had an obsession to use. You know, I thought about what had happened to me that I was able to lose this obsession. You see, the reason why I went back out to use was, like I said, I never really accepted that my life was unmanageable and that I was powerless over my addiction. I knew I was a drug addict. No doubt in my mind I was a drug addict. But yet, deep back in my mind, I still believed that if circumstances were different, if the situation was different, if I had those breaks, if I had that job and that money and the nice apartment and the nice lady, and I had all these things going for me, if I had those breaks, maybe I could handle my life. Maybe I could really, you know, maybe I could drink once in a while. I really believed this. I really believed this. I didn't realize that at the time I was insane. Because everybody around me knew that it was impossible. I had never been able to do it. But I still believed that it was a lie. It was an illusion that I was believing in. And when I came the last time I was at Synanon, during the time that I was there, it came to me. I realized that no way on earth could I ever use again and get away with it. I saw it. I saw it clearer than I had ever seen it before in my life. And I say this many times, it was like a little light went on in my mind and I saw it. For the first time since I had started using it, I couldn't use anymore. I accepted that first step completely and totally. And that's when the miracle happened. The miracle is that I let go of that illusion. And see, the obsession was part of that illusion that I let go. I don't have any illusions today. I know I can't use. I know I can't drink. I know I can't blow any weed. I cannot take any kind of chemical that will alter my brain, alter my thinking, alter my mind. I'm just as powerless today as I was when I came into the fellowship. And that's how I came in. I came into the fellowship beaten down, really beaten down. And, you know, all my life, I have always had, I grew up with a real strong sense of lack in my life. This is why I've always felt inferior. I've always been lonely. I've always been lonely. Even when I was in a crowd of people, even when I was with my family, I still felt lonely. I felt less than. I felt separated from you people. I never felt any kind of intimacy with anybody, not even my own family. And I think the reason, I know what the reason is now. I've always believed that I was separated from God. I've always believed that. Ever since I was a little boy, I believed I was separated from God. And because I believed that, I suffered from those effects. I felt separated. And all my life I've had this very strong sense of lack in my life. And as I began to grow, these feelings of lack also began to grow with me. And when I was a very young boy, I started using some things to compensate for these feelings. I started using alcohol, and then I started using drugs. And drugs did it better, you know, took away that empty feeling, that it sort of filled that emptiness up better than anything else. Because the drugs that I was using put me in a state of euphoria, and it made everything all right. It gave me instant serenity. That's what it gave me. It gave me serenity. I remember the first time I fixed. I was in a hospital. I was 12 years old. And I had had an operation on my neck. I was born with a deformity of the neck. It was real crooked when I was a little boy. Real stiff and real crooked. And because of that, I became paralyzed from my neck down. All the nerves and everything were really tangled up in there. And they had to go in and untangle those nerves. They had to go into my cervical spine. And this happened when I was 12 years old. And I remember when I woke up, I was in tremendous pain. And my mother was there, and my dad was there, and they had a priest there, because my family is Catholic. And I remember waking up, and I was in this pain, and I started crying. And the nurse came in, and she said, "I'm going to give you something for the pain. If you could move over a little bit, I'm going to give you a shot in the hip." And what she gave me was morphine. And I remember that feeling. I remember that little sensation that goes up your legs, and then it hits you in the back, and it goes up your spine, and it hits you in the back of the neck, and then you get flushed, you know. And all of a sudden, I started feeling better. That pain began to go away. It began to diminish. But it did something else to me. It did something psychologically to me. Because I remember, I looked at my mother and I said, "You know what, Mama? Someday I'm going to get out of this hospital." Because she was crying. I said, "Someday I'm going to get out of this hospital. And I'm going to walk just as good and just as straight as anybody else." And I really meant it. I meant it from the bottom of my heart. And that's what drugs did to me. It gave me the desire to live. But before that, I didn't want to live. I hated this world. This world was a very unhappy place, a painful place. I remember I used to look at myself and I hated myself. I thought I was the most ugliest person in this world. And I used to tell myself, many times I'd ask myself, "Who in the hell is ever going to want to have anything to do with you? You're so ugly." And this is how I grew up. But I never realized how much self-hatred I had until I came to the fellowship. You know, and the thing was that I didn't know that. I was even denying it for myself. I would suppress these feelings. Then I started to drown them out with drugs. And that's what drugs did to me. It gave me the desire to live. And from that moment on, I had to kill myself in order to want to live. Drugs became my life. I got busted from my first position in 1947. And from 1947 until I came to stay in this fellowship in 1962, I spent 70% of that time locked in an institution just for drugs. Just behind drugs. I've been all over the United States just for drugs. And I couldn't stop. I didn't know that at that time, drugs was an answer to my problem. And my problem was that I didn't want to live. But being the wrong answer, it eventually became my problem. And at times it became the biggest threat in my life because I couldn't stay off. You know, this feeling finally got so great, the feeling of lack got so great and so powerful that no amount of drugs could drown it out. No amount of drugs could drown it out. And the weird thing about it, this shows me how powerful the mind is. This feeling of lack became so powerful in my mind that it actually manifested itself in my life in form. When I came to the fellowship, I didn't have anything. I had nothing. I had no job. I had no place to go. My family didn't want me. I remember when I left Finland on Christmas Day, it was December, it was cold, I didn't even have a jacket. I had to borrow a dime from a kid to call my mother's house. They didn't want to have nothing to do with me. They told me they were having a beautiful Christmas. Please don't come here and mess it up. I was bankrupt in every department. It had finally manifested itself and formed this belief in life that I had. You know, and at that time I thought this was the most terrible thing that could have happened to me. But you know what, I look back now and you know what, that was the best day of my life. It was the most beautiful day of my life. I remember after I went out, after being clean and sober for 6 months, I would get loaded and I'd have a body full of drugs and a mind full of the program. And I was miserable. I was miserable. And I remember praying all the time, you know, help me, help me. But the reason why I never made it before is because I was holding on to those old ideas, to those illusions, that I still had control. And it was sort of like God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. He put me in a position where I couldn't deny it anymore. I couldn't deny it. And I saw it clearer than I had ever seen it before. That's when I realized that this fellowship works. Because the thing that happened to me is that the basic principle that is contained within the first step, the principle of honesty, finally penetrated this thick, thick skull of mine. And for a long time, I couldn't be honest. I didn't know how to be honest. See, basically, what my problem is that my perception of myself and my perception about the world and everybody and everything in the world was so distorted that by the time I came here, I didn't know the difference between what was real and what was not real. These illusions that I had, I really believed that they were real. I really believed I had power. And I had to be put in a situation in order to see it. After I had had 6 months of clean time, and I realized that for 6 months I had been coming to this program, I had been coming to meetings every night, and every meeting I came to I heard the truth. And the truth is that if you be an addict, you cannot control your using and you cannot manage your own life. I heard it over and over and over. I heard the truth. I never accepted it until that day when I was at Cinnamon. I finally accepted the truth. And you've heard it many times, you know. Know the truth because the truth will set you free. Know the truth because the understanding of the truth will set you free. It'll first piss you off, but it'll set you free. And this is what it did to me. It penetrated this mind of mine. Like I said, a little bit of light went on. And when I talk about light, what I'm really referring to is a deeper understanding. That's what light represents in the mind. Deep understanding. And that's how I came here. I came here completely... Everything I had going for me all my life was destroyed. And I finally had to get to that point in order to start building a whole new way of life for myself. Because the lifestyle that I live by, I finally realized that it didn't work. It didn't work. My best thinking got me here. My best thinking almost killed me. That's how good my mind is. That's how good my thinking is. That's how much power I have. And I saw it. I was able to be honest with myself and I saw it and I accepted it. And I guess I gained a little humility by having to go back out there and having to beat myself up so bad that I came back crawling and I came back humble. And I'm grateful that I got here. But to me, humility means the willingness to accept the truth. That's what willingness is. Open-mindedness. That's what humility is. In other words, what I was saying was, I don't have the answers. I was saying there's something terribly wrong and I can't fix it. And I came in and I opened my mind to new ideas, new suggestions. I began to follow directions. I went to meetings every night. And one of the things I told myself, the first year I came back, I said, you know what, I have nothing to share. I'm going to keep my mouth shut for 1 year. I'm going to go to meetings and just listen. I have to listen. Because I have the tendency to, you know, I'm a liar. I've been a liar all my life. And everything, every time I open my mouth, nothing but bullshit comes out. And I've been doing it for so long that I finally began to believe it myself. And sure, my friend. This is not a question and answer, my friend. So anyway, you know, I finally had gotten to that point where I was willing to open my mind. I was willing to accept new direction. And I didn't realize it, but I was beginning to practice some of the principles that are contained within the steps of this program. The principle of honesty is one. The principle of humility is another. And there's another one. The principle of faith. And when I got here, I didn't have any faith. I didn't have any faith in myself. I didn't have any faith in God, or I had no faith in any kind of system. But as I stayed here, and I began to see other people get clean and sober and stay clean and sober, this gave me faith. And pretty soon I had a 6 months, and then I had 9 months, and pretty soon I got a year. You know, and as my time grew on this program, my faith began to grow on this program. And there's also the principle of courage. Courage to me is a state of mind that will enable me to face whatever I have to face and not have to go out there and use. And that's a hard one for me. See, because basically, I've been a coward all my life. I've been running all my life. I didn't know anything about courage. In fact, it was foreign to me. You know, but when I have a little trouble with that courage, I go to the next principle, which is the principle of appreciation, or you can call it gratitude. You know, no matter how bad things seem to be in my life, no matter how bad the situations are in my life, if I can look into my life and be honest, there's always something I can be grateful for. Always something. There has been times since I've been sober that I have felt very down. I felt very sad. My heart was broken. But even in those moments, when I could go be by myself and meditate a little while, I could always find something to be grateful for. Now, I remember, when I was about 8 years clean on this program, something happened in my life that changed my whole life. Is when we discovered that my two sons were sick. I had two sons with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And we didn't know what it was. I had no idea what muscular dystrophy was. So I thought to myself, and by this time, you know, the program was good to me. By this time, I had built a little business for myself. I was a roofing contractor. I had two full-time crews going. I had a little business that was so prosperous, it was spitting money. And I was able to provide my family with the nice things in this world. A nice automobile, a nice little home, good food, nice clothes. I felt good about myself. For the first time in my life, I felt like I was somebody. I felt like I had finally gotten there. And then when this thing happened, I couldn't handle it. It just tore me up. Like I said, I didn't know what it was in the beginning. And I thought to myself, well, I can afford it. I can get the best doctors and the best medicine. Send them to the best doctors or the best hospitals, whatever they need. I can afford it. And my wife wrote a letter to the Muscular Dystrophy Association in New York to find out what we can do to help the boys. And it was about a week or a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks after. I came home from work and I found my wife in the kitchen completely destroyed. And I asked her what was wrong, and she told me to read the brochure. And in the brochure, they explain muscular dystrophy, and there's several types of muscular dystrophy. Duchenne is what the children get, and it's fatal. And there's nothing they can do. There's no medicine, there's no cure, there is absolutely nothing they can do for these children. It's one of the biggest killers of children. What happens is they get weaker and weaker and weaker, and eventually they end up in a wheelchair. And then they lose their strength more and more until finally they can't even sit up in the chair. And it gets to a point where they get so weak that they catch a cold, they can't fight it and they die. And they're lucky if they live to be 16 years old. They're lucky. When I found out that, it was sort of like, my God, what's happening? I walked around in a daze. I said, what is happening? And there's got to be a joke. The thing that came to me more than anything else I remember is the feeling of guilt. I felt guilty. I thought maybe I caused this. And after that guilt, that anger came in. I was angry at myself. I was so angry at myself. And I projected it at God. I projected it at my family. I projected it at my friends. It was the anger that I was angry at me. I realize that now. But it got so bad that my family couldn't tolerate me. And I had to move out of the house. And I stayed away from home for a year and a half. The only time I would go there would be once a week. I'd go there and I'd pick up all the bills and I'd take the wife shopping and I'd make sure they had everything they needed. Everything they needed. And then I'd leave them alone. And I lost my business behind this. I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't work. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I actually physically got sick. What I did is I escaped from work. I got 2 full-time jobs. I got 2 8-hour-a-day jobs. I had to go from one job to another job and go home and crash. Get up in the morning, go 8 hours here, go to the other job 8 hours, and go home and crash. I did this for a year and a half. I never missed a day. I never was tardy. I never took a vacation. I just worked and worked and worked. And finally, at the end, I wasn't going to any more meetings. I wasn't talking to anybody. I wouldn't tell anybody what was happening inside. I've never been able to tell anybody what's happening inside. And I'd meet people on the program and say, Pepe, how are you doing? I'm doing fine. I'm working a lot of hours, but I'm doing fine. How's the family? We're fine. We're fine. And I was dying inside. And I realized that this is why I've never been able to be close with anybody. I shut people off. And I realized after I got in the program that my self-perception was so bad. I always thought I was the worst, the ugliest, the dumbest, anything bad, that was me. And deep inside I used to think, if you ever see who I really am, you won't want to have anything to do with me. So what I did is I began to build a mask. And I would only let you so far, and I'd stop you. Even women that I became intimate with, physically, never really knew me. My family never really knew me. My teachers never really knew me. Nobody knew me. In fact, I really didn't even know myself. No wonder I was neurotic. I had separated myself from myself. And as Freud defines neurosis, is separation of self. I was completely neurotic. And, my breakthrough came after I had moved to Redding, California. I went back home after a year and a half because I had finally got to the point where I was so depressed. I felt like I was in a black pit and I was very seriously thinking about taking my life. And I went back home. And I told my wife that I had to face this thing with my children. And that I wanted to come home. And I told her, you know what, honey? You're not obligated to me for anything. I just want to come home. And she said, well, you're welcome back. And I've been back ever since. The first thing we did is we moved out of Los Angeles and we went up north to a little place in Redding, California. I got a little house, a little farm, right outside of Lake Shasta. And for 6 years, I stayed there. For 6 years, it was just before my boys went into their wheelchairs. They went into their wheelchairs while I was up north. But it was a time when I was able to take them fishing and take them camping, and I used to take them swimming. And I spent a lot of time with my boys, I had like a little farm there, and I raised all my table meat. I had a year-round garden. They had animals. My horse had a horse. They never rode the horse, but it was their horse. And like I said, my breakthrough came during the time I was in Reading. And what happened was that the Narcotics Anonymous World Convention was being held in Portland, Oregon that year. And they called me, and they asked me, that they were the committee for the convention, and they asked me if I would be their banquet speaker at the convention. And I told them, well, I really couldn't give them an answer. I had to talk it over with my family first, and that I would get back to them maybe the next day or the day after, but I'd get back to them real soon and give them an answer either yes or no. And then when I talked it over with my family, I told them, how can I go there? What can I tell these people? And am I going to tell them that I've been crazy, that I've been separated from my family because I couldn't deal with the situation, that I had so much hatred in me that I'm lucky I didn't kill anybody? And here I am in this little farm up in Redding, California, hiding from the world. What am I going to do? Go tell them what a great program I have? And my son told me something that blew my mind, my oldest son. He says, you know what, Papa? He says, I know that you've gone through some bad changes. I know that you've suffered a lot. I've heard you cry. I've seen you go crazy. I've seen you and Mama argue. He says, but you know what? In spite of all that, you're still clean. Go tell them that. So that's what I did. I went to Portland, Oregon. And I became the banquet speaker. For the first time in my life, I got up there and I let you see me. It was the hardest thing I ever did in my life. It was the first time anybody in the program from Christ. And it was sort of like I stood up there and I was willing to get naked in front of you. I'm not talking about physical nakedness. That's easy. I got up there and I said, this is who I am. I'm frightened. I don't know what to do. I need help. You know, it's even making me physically sick. And I told him that in spite of that, I'm trying real desperately to stay clean and sober. So far, I've been able to do it. And that was the beginning of the real intimacy I have now with the fellowship. Because that's what makes it, that's what makes for intimacy. All my life, I've been running around this world trying to find someone or something to become one with. Because I've always felt separated. I guess deep back in my mind, there still is an ancient memory when I was at one with my father. And I long for that. We all do. We all do. We all want to go back home. And we want to feel at one with God. And I've been looking for God in this world, thinking I would find it in you or in you and you. And I used to think if I could only find that right person, that right person, then Pepe would be all right. If I only had that right job, then Pepe would be all right. If I only had those things, then I would be all right, because these things would establish my work. Then I wouldn't be a nothing. I'd be a somebody. And the reason why I never found it is because these things of this world can never establish my worth. Because my worth has already been established by God in my creation. I didn't know that. I didn't know that. See, I still believe in the thought system of the ego, which is a thought system that is completely, totally insane. The reason why I say that is because the ego believes that he is what he is not. The ego believes he's God. And that's a part of our mind that says, you don't need any help. You don't need that religion. You don't need that church. You don't need that God shit. You can do it. And that's the voice I've been following all my life. See, there are only two thought systems in this universe. There's the thought system of fear, and there's a thought system of love. They're the only two that exist. And we believe in either one or the other to be true all the time, even when we're asleep. And there is never a time when we can believe in both of them at the same time. Because love and fear cannot coexist. It's impossible. You cannot worship two masters at the same time. You have to worship one or the other. The master I've been worshiping all my life was the thought system of fear, which is the thought system of the ego. See, the ego believes in this world of form. The ego believes that that's the only reality that exists. And that it was brought into this world by other egos. It was made by other egos. My mom and dad got together and they made another ego. And the ego believes that it is a body. And that it will be in this world a very short time. And during the time it's in this world, it's subject to all kinds of danger. To attack, to sickness, eventually to old age and into death. And this is why most of us, when we hear the word death, it frightens us. Because the ego doesn't believe that there's anything after death. The ego only believes in what it can see, touch, feel, hear, taste. The ego is the five senses. That's the world of the five senses. And the ego believes that everything it needs in order to find fulfillment and happiness in this world is to be found outside himself, in the world of form. And this is what the world teaches. Go out and get that good job, get that good education, get that big home, get that big money, get that this and get that, and then you'll be happy. The things of this world cannot make you happy. They'll give you comfort. They'll give you pleasure. But they will not make you happy. Happiness is an inside job. I didn't know that when I got here. And this is the process that I live by. I live by fear all my life. Everything that I ever did in my life was motivated by fear. I didn't realize it. But when I came to this fellowship was about to introduce me to a thought system completely opposite to the one I came in with. And that's the thought system of love. That's the thought system of the spirit. And this is what this whole program is about. That's the thought system of love. And you know, for many, many years, I believed that I had many, many defects of character. I don't. I really don't. I only have one. And that's fear. Fear is the only defect of character I have. The reason why I believe that I had many is because that fear manifests itself in different ways. It manifests itself in anger, in envy, in malice, in jealousy, in violence. I mean, I can go on and on. It's all fear. And for a long time, I thought these were my defects of character. They are. But basically, the underlying cause is fear. So basically, I only have one defect of character. Fear. And just the same way, love also manifests itself in many, many ways. It manifests itself in deep understanding, which is light. In sharing, in giving, in kindness. Gentleness, patience, courage, humility. And this is the this is what the program teaches us. We call them spiritual principles, but they're attributes of love. This is why this program is a program of miracles. Because the thing that inspires miracles is the love that's in this program. And the love I'm talking about is the love that goes from one heart to another heart, to another heart, to another heart, to another heart. That's what inspires miracles. The love we give to each other. The love we give to the newcomer. And sometimes we have to share even a little more than just our experience, our strength, and our hope. Sometimes we have to share our home and our food. Sometimes we have to give them an extra shirt because they don't have it. Sometimes we have to give them a little money. But it's the love behind our giving that inspires miracles. And miracles should happen naturally and spontaneously as an expression of that love. And when a miracle doesn't happen, it's because the love has been interrupted. And the thing that interrupts the love is our resentment and our hatred and our malice and our judgment and our gossip and all our evil stuff. That's what interrupts the love. So today I have a choice. Do I want to live in ego consciousness or do I want to live in God consciousness? Do I want to live in love or do I want to live in fear? This program has taught me how to love. And I don't try to fool anybody. It isn't my love. That love was in this world long before I came into this world. That's God's love. If I can let myself be used as a channel so that God can manifest his love through me to my family, to my friends, and even to my enemies, then I'm the one that eats of the fruit. I'm the one that benefits. I'm the one that feels the love. And when I feel the love, I feel God's presence in my life. He goes, what is God? God is love. You know, all my life, I've been looking for God in these churches and over here and in these books. You know, and there was a master who walked this earth 2,000 years ago and he told us where to look. He says, the kingdom of God is within. My Father and I are one. If I choose to make my bed in hell, my Father will be there with me because we are one. See, when God created me, and he created you, he didn't create something other than himself. What he did, he projected of himself. He made more of himself. He extended of himself. He extended his mind. That's who we are. We are an extension of God's mind. We are a thought. And it's a loving thought. That's who we are. And that mind has been referred to in many ways. It's been referred to as the collective unconsciousness, or it's been referred to as the sonship, or you could call it the Christ mind. In fact, there's only one of us in here. Because that mind that was in Jesus, and that mind that was in Buddha, and that mind that was in Krishna, is in you and I and everybody in this room. We all are part of that same mind. Whether we understand it or not, or want to believe it or not, we are in telepathic communication all the time. This is why whenever I attack you, I attack myself. Whenever I love you, I love myself. To the world, I really give to myself. And this is what this program has taught me. In order to keep what I have, I have to give it away. I have to give it away. Or I'm going to lose it. And it's not that I'm going to lose it, but what good is something if you don't use it? What good is something? I can never lose it. Because this is part of my natural inheritance as a child of God. And today, the emptiness that I've had all my life is not there anymore. There are times when I do feel down and I do feel empty, but not like it was before. You know, this is why, you know, after 25 years of being clean, I'm so grateful, because the things that I have today in my life, I feel so blessed with. And sometimes you look back and you see the most terrible things, you see were blessings in disguise. When I came in, that was a blessed day. I came in without anything. Because then I was ready to build a whole new life. I was able to build a whole new life on rock. Because the life I had was built on sand. And when the rains came and the wind came, I fell. And that sand I'm referring to is the thought system of fear. And the thought system that I talk about now, which is the one of rock, is the thought system of love. Because the rains have come in my life. And the winds have come in my life. It has rained in my life. And I'm still clean and sober. My wife has 1 month more sobriety than I do. you know what? There's a lot of love and a lot of happiness in my heart, even in spite of what we're going through, because my perception of what is happening has changed. I don't perceive it with fear anymore, because I know that no matter what happens, my boys and I, we're safe. We're safe because we are not this body. Our true identity is only spiritual. We are invisible. We are beautiful. We are eternal. We are holy, which means complete. We are unlimited. And this is what I love about this program, is because this program is teaching us how to become that magnificent man and that magnificent woman that we should be. And whenever I get up here and I say, you know what, in truth, I'm beautiful, that's not an arrogant statement. That's a humble statement. Because what I'm saying is, that's who I am because God made me that way. I would be arrogant if I say I was anything less. Because what I'm saying is that I made myself. I took something that God made and changed it. That's arrogance. Just about out of time. But I want to say that this has been a privilege to me. And I've said this many times. I don't care how far I have to go. I have to give away what I have because I don't want to lose what I have. I'll go to any length to give away what I have, to share with you what I have. Because like I said, when I give to you, I give to myself. It's like I take it out of my left-hand pocket and I put it in my right-hand pocket. It never leaves me. In fact, it increases. The more I give, the more I have. And this is how I feel tonight. When I go home tomorrow morning, I sort of feel like my pockets are full. I have everything I need. Everything I need and more. I have some extra to give away. And for that, I'll be eternally grateful. So once again, I want to say I hope you have a beautiful, happy New Year, and God bless all of you.